Let's see. So this Shabbat is Va'era. It's also Rosh Chodesh, Rosh Chodesh Shvat. Very special day.
It's my birthday on Saturday, Bet Shvat.
Bet Shvat, Sunday. Yes. That's wonderful.
But it starts on Saturday night.
Yes,
so
Saturday night. Beautiful, wonderful. So here we are, Va'era. And if we can begin a few lines earlier. If we can begin at verse 22 from the previous parsha. You're okay?
Yeah.
Minnie, would you like to say it in Hebrew? Vayashav Moshe el Hashem.
Vayashav Moshe el Hashem vayomer Adonai, lama her'ata la'am hazeh, lama zeh shelachtani. ומאז באתי אל פרעה לדבר בשמך, הרע לעם הזה והצל?
והצל
לא הצלת את עמך.
Okay, can you translate that, please?
Moses returned to God and said, O Lord, why do you mistreat your people? Why did you send me? As soon as I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he made things worse for these people. You have done nothing to help your people.
Right. So there we have this amazing statement.
This is a very strong statement.
Moshe has begun. I mean, in the previous Sedra, he came to Pharaoh. He said, let my people go. Pharaoh said, oh, you're disturbing the people from their work. They're all lazy. Now I'm not going to give them straw for the bricks, right? Famous idea. They still have to make the same number of bricks. And the people are now very unhappy, and they're very unhappy because Moshe has appeared in order to save them, but all he's done, as far as they're concerned, he's stirred things up and made things worse. And it also affects Moshe. He also calls out to God and is very upset about this. All right, so now let's...
To be cheeky of Moshe. To speak like that to God.
Right, now that's a very...
He was frustrated, you know, he didn't want to go spokesman, he was pushed and said, you're the man, and he goes there and he said, well, I didn't want to go, but the moment I say anything, it's made matters worse. What's the point?
Well said.
Yeah. So, Shaul, would you like to say verse 1, which is the last verse of last week's Sedra? Vayom Hashem.
Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, ata tir'eh asher ha'aseh lefaro, ki b'yad chazaka yeshalchem, u'b'yad chazaka yegershem me'arzo. V'adaber...
Do you want to translate that?
Yeah. God said to Moses, now you will begin to see what I will do to Pharaoh. He will be forced to let them go. But he will be forced to drive them out of his land.
Right, okay, so that sounds very comforting. But in fact, Rashi makes the comment, you will see what I do to Pharaoh, but you won't see what I do to the rulers of the land of Canaan, because you will not be entering the land of Canaan. So according to Rashi, the decision that Moses shouldn't enter the land of Canaan is made right now.
That I find very, very far-fetched, with all due respect to Rashi. That, you know, his mate said, you know, you'll see what I do to Pharaoh. How can you then link that to the fact that he hasn't said, oh, but you won't see what I'm doing? To me, that's fantasy. So.
Okay, so let's try to explore it. That's how the Midrash puts it, which Rashi is quoting. Now, we all find it a little bit strong, the way that Moses takes arms against God. Why have you done this? You haven't saved the people. You haven't done... it's just got worse for them.
Yeah.
One way of understanding this, there are a number of different ways of looking at it, but one way, as indeed you presented very good arguments yourself, but one way of understanding it is that Moses so much identified with the children of Israel, that the Jewish people, that he became angry on their behalf, even though he is the Ish Elohim, the man of God, the person who's going to give the Torah, the person who is so spiritual and holy. But when it comes to the Jewish people suffering, he is with them. He is together with them. In fact, we see in last week's Sedra that the first moment that we come to know Moses as a grown-up person is that he sees an Egyptian hitting a Jew and he goes over to the Egyptian and kills him. He cannot tolerate the pain that the Jewish people are suffering. Yeah. Now, that sense of incidentally, Maimonides, the Rambam, in his Moreh Nebuchim, in Guide for the Perplexed, he has a whole section on Nevuah, prophecy. And he gives several different categories. If my memory isn't wrong, 14 different categories of prophecy. The first of which is seen in Moshe defending the Jew against the Egyptian, and then as someone who is fleeing from Pharaoh, and he comes to the land of Midian, and he comes to a well, and there are these seven girls who are supposed to be drawing water for their sheep, and the shepherds won't let them. And Moshe, who is a stranger, barges in and says, "Get away from here, you shepherds," and he draws water for the seven girls, and he ends up marrying one of them, Zipporah. But that heroism, the Rambam writes about as the first degree of prophecy. The first level of Nevuah isn't necessarily about telling the future. That's a variety of Nevuah. Nevuah is that a divine spirit beats inside the person's heart. And when that beats in the person's heart, they cannot allow injustice to take place, and they have to do something about it. Now, another quality is this sense of identity with the Jewish people. Moses cannot let this go. It's become worse for the Jewish people. So what is he supposed to be? Just be there with folded arms and say nothing? He's going to complain to God. Now, that links with him not going into the land of Israel. How could he go into the land of Israel? His people, these same people whom he brought out of Egypt, were condemned to die in the desert. Moshe does not want to leave them. He remains with them. He remains with them in the desert, and it's Joshua who goes into the land of Israel with the next generation.
I got no problem with that.
But that's an interesting point, because I never knew that was what happened. That some of the older years, didn't go in, that the old generation actually remained in the desert.
Well, you know that's because of the spies.
Yes, but...
But you see, it depends how you look at it. Because of the spies, the older generation didn't go in. They wept. It was actually the night of Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, when the spies came back with their report about the land of Israel. There are giants there, we won't be able to conquer it. And everyone wept. And God said, and the spies had been wandering around Israel 40 days. So God said, right, they wandered 40 days, you're going to wander through the desert 40 years. And in that time, you will all reach an age where they're expected to die at 60. Very young, by today's standards. And by theirs, I mean, Moses lived till 120.
Is this more fascinating? I had no idea.
So God said that they're going to die. But those are the Anshe Moshe. Those are Moses' close people. Those are the people that Moshe is dedicated to. So that's the link.
I've got no problem with that. What I can't buy... It's because God says to him, "You have a look what I'm going to do to Pharaoh," right? That is saying that he's not going to. To me, there's no connection with that.
Well, that's the Midrashic method. The Midrashic method is unpacking the text. It's a fascinating thing. You should know that the Midrash has excited a lot of interest, you know, in 20th century, not just biblical study, literary study, and applying literary theory to Midrash. because it is quite a fascinating thing, these different levels of meaning, and that you can work out what the text is saying by what it doesn't say. Or it's emphasizing A, and by emphasizing A, you suddenly notice B. You see, atatire, now you will see, like a very powerful statement, now. Why does that word now have to be there?
Because it's now. Now. It's now it's going to happen. Not in a year's time, not in 10 years. Now you will see what I'm going to do.
Well, actually,
you say it's unpacking the thing. To me, it's padding and seeing things which really, to me, I can't accept it. I can't accept that. Having
well, you in the Midrash, you would be another opinion.
So what do you mean by
Rabbi this will say this statement, and Rabbi you will say something else.
What do you mean by unpacking?
No, it doesn't mean that. It means kipshuto. It means just its literal sense. Yes, Shaul.
What do you mean by unpacking the text?
You see, let's take this painting on the wall. This painting is communicating something, and a certain images are there presented. But what is the meaning behind it? Is it telling a story? Is it saying something about existence? Is it saying something about a mood? There's a whole lot more which is there. If a person just looks blankly at the painting, so what do they see? You know, swirls of different colours. But if you're looking with a more, you know, in a sense, an eye which has got a more cognition in it. And also, if you've looked at many paintings, and you can see certain elusive qualities. You know, one painting refers to other paintings. There are messages being conveyed. It's evoking certain concepts. So the way in which this phrase, this verse, Atatire, now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. So you can put it in a very, you know, simple way. And certainly Mikra, Eina Mikra Yotze Mide Pshuto. The verse does not leave its simple literal sense, and the literal sense makes good sense and it's perfectly right. But also, there may be all kinds of other colors and shadows and evocations which are there in the verse. It might have a certain numerical value. Sometimes this word has this numerical value. Another word somewhere else has the same numerical value. There's a link. And the way that Rashi puts it is that this you will see, but that you won't see. So it's like a point counterpoint.
Remind me why Moshe was not allowed to go to the land of Canaan.
Well, you see, there's the surface mean reason, and then other reasons. The surface reason is that the second time that water was needed from the rock, he hit the rock. God said to him, speak to the rock, and instead of speaking to it, he hit it. The first time he did hit it, he was told to hit the rock. But then many, many years later, Miriam passed away, and the rock, this well, this miraculous well, which flows water all the time from a rock. Yes, this is beyond modern technology.
Yes.
That you have a rock, and the rock moved with them, and all the time this rock was a well. It was a spring of water. But that spring of water came through the merit of Miriam, Moses' sister. In many ways, Miriam is the heroine of the whole story. We'll come to that in a moment. But so when she passed away, the flow of water stopped.
Yeah.
So now everyone is thirsty. There's no water anymore. So they gather around Moshe, they say, we're thirsty, give us something to drink, give us water. So God says to him, speak to such and such a rock. Because he couldn't find the rock anymore. The rock which had been pouring water has disappeared. It's the water stopped and there's just rocks all around. So he finds a rock and he thinks maybe this is it. And he speaks to it and nothing happens. And he hits it.
Because he's angry.
He's upset.
Frustrated. But why would why would he be punished for that?
Well, you see, that's the surface reason.
Yeah.
Because, so the rationale, you know, Rashi gives an interesting rationale that people would say, you speak to a rock and it gives its water, God should speak to us and we will do what we are told as well, but in fact, the way it came out, the rock didn't do what it was supposed to do, and he hit the rock, it went wrong. But on another dimension, Moses didn't want to go into the land of Israel without his people. His people had died in the desert by the time the 40 years were up.
I have a question about Miriam. I thought that she kind of tarnished herself a bit when she talked about a Cushit, referring to Moses's wife.
Right. She tarnished herself in that she was criticizing her brother.
Yeah.
What was she criticizing her brother for?
I don't remember, but I remember that she was talking about his wife.
All right. So let's go back to the beginning of the story with Miriam. It's very interesting that in last week's Sedra, it tells us that a man from the house of Levi married a woman from a daughter of Levi, and then they had a child, and the child is Moshe.
Right, yes.
And Moshe's sister is there already. And Aaron, his older brother, they've already got two children. Why did they marry? They married long ago. No. Because they were depressed, Pharaoh made a decree to kill every boy child. Every boy child has to be thrown into the river Nile. So Amram and Yocheved, the parents of Miriam and Aaron, got very upset. And they said, there's no point having children. We're going to get divorced. And so they got divorced so that they would not have any more children, because what would happen if it's a little boy, he'll be thrown into the river and drown.
Right.
So Miriam, this is how the Midrash puts it. So Miriam said to her parents, your decree is worse than that of Pharaoh. Pharaoh only decreed that the little boy should be killed, and by you refusing to have children, you're also making a decree against little girls. So they said, you know what? You're right. We're going to get married again. And so Amram and Yocheved remarried, and their first child was Moshe.
Now, there's nothing actually written about this. This is been synonymized.
Yeah. Well, this is the Midrash. This is the Midrash. You see, the Midrash helps you understand the tone of voice of the Torah. It's very interesting. What is the general view of the Torah, what's called the Old Testament? It's read by most people without the Midrash, without Rashi, without the Jewish framework of what's taking place. And many people see it as something very harsh, very negative.
It's true.
It's full of punishment, stoning, this, that, the other. Next, to be honest, etc. You know, all of which is somehow muted and changed and softened and nuanced by the teachings of the sages. You know, when they say eye for an eye, they immediately say that doesn't mean literally, God forbid. It means monetary compensation, the whole idea of monetary compensation. So the commentary and the framing by the sages is something fundamentally important to understand what is actually being communicated by the Torah. So there we have Miriam. And Miriam also, when little Moshe was put in a basket in the river Nile,
she watched over him.
She watched over him, and she did a very clever thing. The Egyptian princess found him. and recognized that this is a Jewish child. She opened the basket, looked at this baby. He was circumcised. And she knew her father had decreed all the Jewish children should be thrown into the Nile, so she can understand this is a Jewish mother who she's done what the king declared they have to do, putting a child in the Nile. The only thing is she's put him in a little basket so he shouldn't drown, and there he is. And what happened next? What did Miriam do next?
She probably approached her.
Yeah.
To say, well, if you're looking for a someone,
a smart Jewish cop.
Yeah, for someone to nurse him.
That's right, a nursemaid.
A nursemaid.
I've got someone.
I can help you. Yeah,
that's right. And so Moses went back to his mother for a couple of years, or 3 years, until he was weaned. And so there he was, drinking milk from his mother and getting all the kind of spiritual input that his mother and their home would give, due to Miriam's sharp Yiddish cup, as you say.
Yes.
So she complains later on. This is in the book of Numbers. Now we're in the book of Exodus, but two books further on, the book of Numbers. So she complains, it says, about the Isha HaKushit, who was Moses' wife. So Rashi says, what is she complaining about? She's complaining. Now, the Isha HaKushit is Tzipora.
Yeah.
According to Ibn Ezra, Tzipora was black.
Yeah.
That's how she was all the time. She came from Midian, and the Midian people are black. That's Ibn Ezra's view. Rashi's view is that she's not black, but people called her black. But what is Miriam complaining? Because shortly before then, a whole group of people had become prophets. 70 people had been made into a kind of Sanhedrin, and they had all begun prophesying. So this is Rashi, right, from the Midrash. And when Tzipora heard about that, she said, oh, I feel so sorry for their wives.
Tzipora or Miriam?
Tzipora.
Tzipora, yes.
Why? Why do you feel sorry for their wives? Well, look what happened to me. My husband became a great prophet and he doesn't sleep with me anymore. So Miriam says about her brother, to her other brother, Aaron, you know what Moshe is doing? He's not sleeping with his wife, Tzipora. We all heard God speaking at Mount Sinai. We all had a certain spiritual status. Doesn't mean that we should be celibate. Why is Moshe doing this? So that was the complaint.
But why does she refer to her in that derogatory about the color?
Well, according to Ibn Ezra, that's what her color was.
Yeah, but why would you refer
to her? But according to Rashi...
Nochriya.
Sorry?
Nochriya. But because of that, she was not Jewish.
Well, that's not the way Rashi takes it.
Okay.
Rashi takes it that she was very beautiful, and to talk about someone very beautiful, they would put it in some opposite way. So it's like... You know, like not to say, but the point about the woman was, as far as Miriam is concerned, she's a very beautiful woman. Why isn't Moses sleeping with her? That was what bothered her. That's Rashi's perspective.
Yeah, it's funny. I think I told you when I was in Ethiopia in October, they kept saying all the time that she was Ethiopian.
Uh huh. Okay. Well.
Well, it makes sense.
That fits with him.
It's the border.
No, but you say Midian. Yeah. Is in Africa.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Ethiopia is in Africa.
Yeah.
Of course.
No.
So it could be, it's what I mean. It could very well be. Well, there was another woman that came with a king of Israel.
Yeah. Malkat Sheba.
Sheba, yes.
Yes.
Queen of Sheba.
That's how they explain the ancient links between the Jewish people and the Ethiopian people. It started with Moses, and then yes, it went on with King Solomon and Sheba. Mm-hmm.
And there is another thing that I heard from some elders of the Druze community, that they believe that they are descended of Jethro. It's very strong in their
tradition.
It's amazingly powerful tradition that we have, which sends sparks like to different parts of the world. I remember when it was the coronation of the Queen here. So there were, you know, on television there was all this, Westminster Cathedral, and there was a stone, which is supposed to be the stone that Jacob laid his head on. That's somehow part
in
of
Westminster.
The Anglo-Christian. Yes. Myth. All right. So there we have the introduction to our sedra, and then begins our sedra Vayedaber Elokim. Okay, who would like to say it? I think we're back to Millie.
Oh, those eyes. Let me see.
I'm sorry.
No, but it's quite big, son. Vayedaber Elokim el Moshe vayomer elav ani
Hashem
va'era va'era el Avraham el Yitzchak ve'el Yaakov ve'el Shaddai ushmi Hashem lo nodati lahem.
Right, now that's a very interesting
verse. What does it mean, lo nodati ve'lo nodati lahem? Shall I continue?
Well, can you translate?
And God spoke to Moses and
read it, it's easier.
And told him that he is
Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei.
And I have been seen, Abraham and
Isaac, I read myself.
And saw me, and in my name was, when they saw me, as Shaddai.
Right.
But from, I guess, and Shmi is Yud Hei Vav Hei. That name they did not know.
Right.
So obviously there is two different names.
Yes.
Yes, I've heard that before. That it was to Abraham he was yes.
Now, so it doesn't say Ushmi Hashem Lo Hodati Lahem. My name God, I didn't tell them, but lo nodati lahem. They didn't know me through my name Yudke Vavke.
Nodati lo But what is the difference between Shaddai and Yudke Vavke?
Right. Okay. So let's see what Rashi says. Rashi says the name Shin Dalet Yud. That is the way in which God promises things. But the name Yudke Vavke, that is the aspect of God who fulfills the promise. The patriarchs never saw a fulfilled promise. All the time their lives were struggle.
It's true.
Their lives were struggle. God promised them things, and their lives were one bit of struggle after another. Whereas you are going to see the fulfillment of what Yudke Bavke means, that my promises are going to come true now.
So, in a mystical sense, this is a more powerful...
Well, certainly, the name Yudke Bavke is the ultimate name.
Is
why the name Yudke Bavke is extremely holy, cannot be rubbed out, and that's why it's usually not written. It's written as two yuds or something like that, or a letter hey. It's not written in case there should be some problem and it will get rubbed out. I heard Rabbi Jacobovitz, Alav HaShalom, Lord Jacobovitz, he described what happened when he was in school, a little boy in school in Vienna. And someone, a teacher by mistake or someone, wrote on the blackboard, like they had chalk on the blackboard, wrote Yudke Vavke. And suddenly everyone realized they've written Yudke Vavke. What can we do? You can't take a board duster and rub it out.
Oh, I see.
So he described what happened before his eyes as a little boy in school. A man came into the classroom, a carpenter, with a saw, and he began sawing at the blackboard and cut away that piece of wood where it said Yudke Vavke, and presumably they buried that, with Shemot. And then maybe, he didn't say, but maybe they brought another piece of wood and fastened that to the board so the board wouldn't have a hole in it.
Fascinating.
But that was what they had to do. It shows the significance of this name, Yudke Vavke.
Yeah.
And the, and there's tremendous spiritual meaning in the name Yudke Vavke. So the name, so God is saying, my name Yudke Vavke was not revealed to the patriarchs. They didn't see the completion of my promises.
Does it also have to do with the four different realms?
Well, certainly that's one aspect of Yudke Vavke. The four worlds, the Sfirot.
Yeah.
All the Sfirot are hinted at in this name, Yudke Vavke. Yud is like Chochmah, wisdom. He is Bina, understanding. Then Vav is six, like the six Sfirot, Chesed, Gura, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod. And then the last He is Malchut. And in fact, there's a Yudke Vavke inside each of us. The mind, there is Yud, which is the wisdom in the mind. And the wisdom here means the power of inspiration.
Yeah.
Getting an idea. Or it could be reading an idea. You read a concept in the Torah. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. So that idea is there. And then you start meditating on that. You contemplate it. That's the letter He, which takes the Yud and expands it. And it's like the seminal drop is the Yud. Inside the He, like the feminine, where it grows, where this idea, it grows like a baby inside the womb, and then the baby is born as the emotions of the letter Vav, the love and the awe and the, and mercy and Netzach and Hod and Yesod, the endurance and submission and dedication, all those qualities are expressed in the heart of the person, and then they take form in the thought and speech and actions of the person, which is the final He. So that is the thought and speech and action. So in that sense, the Yudke Vavke is really a channel from the divine right down into this world, and each of us express that in our being. There's a Yudke Vavke inside us. See, and in the letter He, there's a rather beautiful image. You see, here we have the letter He. Now, the letter He represents...
It has a roof and a two arms.
Now, the roof is machshava, is thought. And then there is speech. And then there is action. Now, why is there a little space here? Because the action is always distant.
Yes.
You see, there's the thought inside the person, and you can say exactly what you've been thinking. That it can move in a straight line. And action is always, there's a gap.
There's so a distance, that's, yeah.
So that's the letter He representing this this process inside ourselves. And the letter He is a sacred letter.
Yeah, and it was added to Abraham and to Sarah.
Yes. Yes, and when it was added to Abraham, so first of all, his name is Avram.
Yeah.
Avram means exalted father.
Yeah.
Av, the father, who is Ram, who is exalted, like beyond. Avraham, and now, Avram, what is the gematria of Avram? Let's just have a look at that.
Yes.
So that's three, you're quite right. And Resh is?
200.
And Mem?
40.
Good. 243. And the letter He is what?
Five.
So with the letter He, it comes to 248. 248 is the, according to the sages, the number of limbs in the body.
Of limbs in the body.
So that means...
Shasa.
Shasa. No, Shasa is 365, is the number of sinews in the body and the number of days in the solar year.
Okay.
But Ramach, Resh Mem Chet, is 248.
Max, I think.
248 limbs in the body. So when Avraham was given that extra hay in his name, it meant that his whole body now expressed holiness. And the letter hey is like the five senses. And so now the five senses are able themselves to express holiness, so he is able to be with Sarah and bring Isaac into the world.
So everybody should have a hey in his name, really, when you name a child. One should think about it, no?
Well, does that mean that everyone's name has to add up to 248?
No. Just a hey itself, no?
Well, we all have a hey.
Hi.
Sorry.
Hi, how are you? Yes.
I'm very well. I just got a lift from somebody who you think knows you. Ruth Temple?
Ruth Temple?
Yeah, she's sells LED lights. I don't know.
Okay.
But she knows your name.
All right.
Oh, I know.
No,
she gives
help,
no?
Go the screen, yeah. And I had my car elsewhere.
Is your car all right? Is your car all right?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I just said I was at a networking meeting.
Is she in Kabbalah business?
Yeah.
Kabbalah business?
Kabbalah center.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah. I see.
It's all right.
Okay.
You said before that Moses wanted to stay with the Israelites in the desert. But
yeah.
I thought he outlived them, no? He could have gone to the land of Canaan without them.
Yeah, but he wanted to be... this is the way, the sort of Hasidic damage. Moses had a connection with the people he took out of Egypt. Now, they were not able to go into the land of Israel because of the whole affair with the spies. So from Moses' point of view, he remained with them in order to be a spiritual melitz, to be an advocate on their behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, Moshe remained with them.
But I thought they were condemned to spend 40 years in the desert because of other reasons.
Well,
because of the
Egel Azav. That's... The Egel Azav, the golden calf, is a major problem. But it's the
spies, no?
It's the spies. It's the
doubt.
Sorry?
The doubt,
the rebellion. The rebellion that was caused on account of the spies.
But they have already completed 40 years in the desert when the spy scandal broke out.
No.
They were on the verge of entering the land.
The spies were a very short time after leaving Egypt.
Are you sure?
Yes. You see, they left Egypt. It took 7 weeks for them to get to Mount Sinai, and they got the Torah. Then they spent a year making the sanctuary. Finally, a little bit less than a year. Then they finally made the sanctuary, and they're ready to move and go to Israel straight away, which was an 11-day journey from where they were. But before going, they sent the spies. So they sent the spies. The spies came back with a terrible report. 10 of the spies. 2 of the spies were Yehoshua and Caleb. They brought back a positive report. But it was the other 10, they brought back the negative report. And everyone began weeping. And so God declared, you're going to wander in the desert for 40 years, like they spent 40 days wandering. And that was... So therefore, instead of in the second year after leaving Egypt, they would have been in Israel. Instead of that, they wandered for 40 years. And at the end of that 40 years, Moses died. Because Moses was 80 when the whole story began.
So where did they go for 40 years if they were still close?
They just wandered around.
Around and around.
Arya Kaplan, who's the editor of wrote this translation, in his book, he provides, you know, a kind of
a map.
Where you can see they're just wandering around east of the Jordan.
So it was not in Sinai?
No. They went through the south of Israel, over into Jordan, Iraq, And that's where they were wandering around. Jordan.
And Moshe.
And then they cross at Jericho, coming back to the west. You see, they're moving westerly over the River Jordan, back into Israel, so going from east to west.
So all the way, the tachanot that they were having in the desert, right at the beginning, is they left Goshen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what sea were they crossing?
Well, that might have been an arm of the Red Sea.
So they went down a bit.
Yes, yeah. It could have been an arm of the Red Sea.
Was the Suez Canal before it was made?
there was a very interesting documentary in that tracing where they would have crossed.
Mm-hmm.
And it went through all the upset. And they have actually found, where they believe it, they have found under their wheels and things dating to that time or at the bottom.
And so where is it?
That was part of the Red Sea.
Ah,
it's cool. I'll see if I can trace back. It's probably on YouTube somewhere. The other thing. But it was very convincing the way it was done.
Also, they were trying to find out scientifically those 10 plagues. How did they happen, and what were the natural causes of them? And there was, I think, on PBS, I saw once a program about it, a very long one, a couple of hours. They actually brought up scientists. It all happened. I mean, it was a chain reaction for the first few. If this happened, this would have happened from this, and this would have happened from this, scientifically. I don't remember how.
Well, there's a wonderful comment by Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra visited London, and he writes the comment.
Where was he based?
Ibn Ezra came from Spain.
Yeah, I thought he was in Egypt or
At some point he was in Egypt too.
Maybe, but he was...
What time are we talking?
He lived around 1100, something like that.
So he came to London.
Or maybe 1150. So he came to London. He wrote Igeret HaShabbat. It's a famous letter he wrote about Shabbat. Someone claimed that the Jewish day doesn't begin from the evening, but from the morning. And he wrote a whole letter saying, what are you talking about? It begins from the evening. That's how we keep Shabbat, from the evening. I think that's the theme of the letter. So, but he experienced London. And one of the aspects that he experienced in London is London fog.
Oh, yes.
Right? London was a little much smaller than it is now, but there on the Thames.
Yes.
And the wood fires that people were burning, you got a lot of beautiful fog in the middle of the winter. So he makes the comment, it's actually not in his commentary on the Torah, but it's somewhere else in his biblical commentary, maybe on Eicha. He says, regarding the 3 days of darkness in the plague in Egypt, well, I remember the fog in London, and it was just like that. I can remember a fog. When I was a child, you could hold up your hand in front of your face, you wouldn't see it.
Great
joy for us is
those scientists
to
actually pointed out to a volcano that happened somewhere that we know, and I don't remember the name, but the date, the time, and the year, and it coincides with the biblical thing. And they believe that it was in such a magnitude that it would have darkened everything on that side of it. It was fascinating just to hear these people debating it with scientific material in front of them and proving that this was scientifically possible. Yeah. It happened.
Yeah.
Well, there's scientific pshat and scientific midrash.
I was thinking about Ibn Ezra in Cairo because there is a synagogue called Ibn Ezra, as far as I remember. I think this is where the...
Well, he was a very great rabbi and a very great scholar, and they might well call the synagogue after him, even if he didn't actually go there. Mm-hmm. He was very poor.
Yeah, the Geniza, I think, was...
He said if he made shrouds, people would stop by and stop dying.
My father once said,
"If he makes what, sorry?
If he made shrouds for the dead, shrouds, then no one would die."
That if I'd be a chevra kadisha, or somebody that deals with the dead, then people will not die. It was my grandfather's saying.
Now, so we come back to so God is mentioning the patriarchs. God said to Moshe, we're just in the first couple of lines. We read the previous lines at the end of last week's sefer, where Moses complains bitterly to Pharaoh, to God. Moses complains to God, "I went to Pharaoh, and things got worse, and you haven't saved the Jewish people." So God is speaking to Moses and saying, "I'm God. I revealed myself to the patriarchs." Now, why does God mention the patriarchs? So one of the commentaries on this, one of the Midrashic commentaries said, God is saying, "I reveal myself to the patriarchs, made them all kinds of promises, none of which really came true. And they never complained. You are complaining right away." So it's like an accusation back at Moshe. Moshe is complaining on behalf of the Jewish people. Now, one way of understanding that is that he is so involved with the people, he feels so much their pain, that he is complaining to God. The other way of understanding it is that Moshe represents the quality of chokhmah, wisdom. So, from the point of view of wisdom, it doesn't make sense. God sends you to Egypt to bring the Jews out of Egypt. He gives you all kinds of miraculous things that you can show Pharaoh. The rod turns into a serpent, and the water changes into blood, and this happens and that. And in fact, what happens is Pharaoh makes things worse for the Jewish people. It doesn't make sense from the point of view of Chochmah. See, Moshe is a Isha Emet, a man of truth. It doesn't work. What's going on? See, from Aaron is a much more nuanced person. But that can be a problem. That's why Aaron was the one who made the golden calf. Moshe would never have made the golden calf. If it would have been Moshe, maybe the people would have killed him. But he would not have made the golden calf.
How could he be forgiven for that, Aaron?
Well, we all do things sometimes which
need to
be...
This is beyond...
Did he go into Canaan?
No, he didn't. And he lost two of his sons.
For a different reason.
According to Rashi, that's why they died. They brought strange fire, or they were drunk, or they did something without asking, or they weren't married, they were intensely spiritual. But as far as Aaron was concerned, his two sons died because he made the golden calf. Really, all four of his sons should have died. But Moses prayed for him with such intensity that two of the sons were spared, but two of them died.
A horrible event.
Well, that's the thing. Moses comes down the mountain and...
And he sees his brother doing the... Oh, brothers.
Okay. So let's see this promise. V'gam hakimoti. Okay, Max, would you like to say this in English?
Mm-hmm.
Which is verse 4, that's right.
On page 283 or 281?
281.
Verse...
Yeah, it's just the beginning of the sentence.
I also make my covenant...
That's right.
I also make my covenant with them promising to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage where they lived as foreigners. I also heard the groaning of the Israelites whom the Egyptians are holding as slaves, and I have remembered my covenant.
Right, so God is now affirming, I remember my covenant with the Jewish people. The simple way of understanding it, Moses is complaining, and God says, don't worry, I remember my covenant with the Jewish people. Don't worry. Yes, things got bad for a bit, but it's going to be all right. That's the simplest pshat reading. Moses complains, and God says, don't worry, everything's going to go as planned, and I remember my covenant with the children of Israel. Would you like to go, Millie? Would you like to say it in Hebrew? Therefore say to the Israelites, verse 6, לכן אמור
לבני ישראל, אני השם, והוצאתי אתכם מתחת סבלות מצרים, והצלתי אתכם מעבודתם, וגאלתי אתכם בזרוע נטויה ובשפטים גדולים, ולקחתי אתכם לי לעם, והייתי לכם לאלוקים, וידעתם כי אני השם אלוקיכם, המוציא אתכם מתחת סבלות מצרים. והבאתי אתכם אל הארץ אשר נשאתי את ידי לתת אותה לאברהם, ליצחק וליעקב, ונתתי אותה לכם מורשה, אני השם.
Okay, that's beautiful. Now, would someone like to translate?
Michael,
would you like to? Therefore, line 6.
Therefore, say to the Israelites in my name, I am Hashem. I will take you away from your forced slavery in Egypt and free you from your slavery. I will liberate you with a demonstration of my power and with great acts of judgment. I will take you to myself as a nation, and I will be to you as a God you will know, and that I am God your Lord, the one who is bringing you out from under the Egyptian subjugation. I will bring you to the land regarding which I raised my hand, swearing that I would give it to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I will give it to you as an inheritance. I am Hashem.
Beautiful. Which festival does this remind you of?
Pesach.
Absolutely. And in fact, the sages tell us that the reason why we have four glasses of wine on Pesach, which is an institution by the sages, like it doesn't say in the Torah.
No,
but you're close. Lachein emor livnei Yisrael ani Hashem. Therefore tell the children of Israel, I'm God. Vohotzeiti etchem. I will take you out from under the suffering of Egypt. Vegaalti etchem. And I will redeem you. That's right. Wait a minute. Velakachti.
Take you as a nation.
Top line.
Oh, no, I've missed one out. Vohotzeiti, I will take you out. And on the same line, vehitzalti. And I will save you. That's on the previous page. Vuga'alti, that's the third one. And then Velakachti, and that's the fourth. So that is the four glasses of wine. Now Shaul quite correctly mentioned Beheveti. That's the fifth glass. That's the Koshel Aliyah. That's when we fill the fifth glass. So they're all here in these couple of verses.
Speaking of Eliyahu, what I forgot. Can you tell me something, tell us something about this book? Tana de Eliyahu.
Oh, wow.
According to this, he wrote it? I mean, this is his words, or this is, what is it?
What a beautiful thing. Well, this book is a very mystical book.
Yeah, it's, I started to read it. It's very interesting, but
as a midrash, it's very beautiful as a midrash, and it's very inspiring, and it's about Jewish identity and being dedicated to Judaism and having Jewish names and Jewish clothing and Jewish language and It's like the spirit of the Jew preserving our identity in a sea of nations. But I'm not sure if they give here the beautiful history of this. You see, we learn in the Talmud. See, here it's got in the introduction. We learn in the Talmud in Tractate Sanhedrin. Rabbi Joshua ben Levi met Elijah. And so there's a whole thing there about Rabbi Joshua ben Levi and Elijah.
There's more light here.
The point is, it is understood, yeah.
Sorry.
But it doesn't actually say it here. You see, there is a tradition that this book is like dictated by Elijah.
That's what I thought.
And there's a very, very mysterious sort of printing history. Because it was printed, there was a manuscript found, and then it was printed very early, and then it was reprinted, and like at every stage, there's some kind of mystical experience.
So this is attributed to Elijah. He actually wrote it. Now, yeah. When exactly did he live? 2,000 years ago?
Elijah? Well, Elijah is Pinchas. Elijah is Pinchas, the son of the grandson of Aaron.
Really?
And then Pinchas somehow becomes Elijah, who is in the time of the kings after Solomon.
Right.
And we have Elijah the prophet. And then Elijah doesn't die.
He
goes, is carried away to heaven. Yes. And Elisha takes over from him.
And so when this occurred?
Well, this is like, I suppose, 100 years after Solomon, something like that.
So it's B'tkufat HaMelachim.
Yeah. The period of the Melachim.
In Israel.
Yeah, in Israel.
Right.
Yeah. Elijah at Mount Carmel. Right?
Yeah, that I remember.
You see,
yeah.
Which is the northern kingdom. Yeah. Achav. Yeah. Achav was the king in the north with Jezebel.
Yeah, and they were horrible people.
Yeah, well, yeah, very problematic. Yes, this is a very beautiful book. That's lovely. That's lovely that you're reading.
It was given to me by Rabbi Scheinberger.
Very nice.
Thank you.
So there's a class reading this Saturday night, Motzei Shabbat. That's Eliyahu HaNavi.
Yeah, we do it after Abdullah, yes.
Yeah. All right. So there we have the Pesach Seder hidden in the words. In the words, including the fifth cup, which is the actual coming into the land of Israel, and the idea that then when Mashiach comes, finally we will have a fifth cup of wine as well. Now the problem is, Vayedaber Moshe Kein. So Shaul, would you like to read verse 9, please?
Vayedaber Moshe Kein el Bnei Yisrael.
Right.
Moses related this to the Israelites, but because of their disappointment and hard work, they would no longer listen to him.
Right, so they couldn't hear him. They're very, very unhappy, but the story goes on, and now begins the whole sequence of the plagues. First of all, it gives a little genealogy, Now, so then comes God on page 287. On page 287 comes this idea that God says to Moses, it's chapter 7, verse 3, I will make Pharaoh obstinate. Yeah, Max, would you like to read that?
Sorry, page? Which page was it?
That's page 287.
Yeah.
In the middle of the page, pretty well. I will make Pharaoh obstinate.
I will make Pharaoh obstinate, and thus will have the opportunity to display many miraculous signs and wonders in Egypt. This is why Pharaoh will not pay attention to you, but then I will display my power against Egypt, and with great acts of judgment I will bring forth from Egypt my armies, my people, the Israelites. When I display my power and bring the Israelites out from among them, Egypt will know that I am God.
Right, now that's... Now that's a fascinating concept, which we're going to come back to. Let's just look a little bit ahead,
we still have time to do things. Moses is 80 and Aaron is 83.
Yes.
And they're just getting started.
Yes. Never too late, Max.
Well, Bernie Eccleston is 86 and he just got kicked out from Formula One.
I don't know who he is. So
he built up Formula One as the racing circuit, and so now he's got to find something else to do.
I'm sure he'll find something if he built something.
I'm surprised he's not Jewish.
Well, the point is that when... When Moshe confronted Pharaoh in last week's Sedra, and he said, God is asking that his people should go, Pharaoh answered, Mi Hashem, who is this God? I don't know this God. So the issue here that we just read is about the idea of becoming aware of God, becoming aware of the power of God. And the way it's expressed here is that Egypt will know that I am God. But is it only Egypt who will know that I am God? To me, this story means it's the Jewish people will know that I am God. Because the Jewish people had assumed the same worldview as the Egyptians.
Of course.
You know, there are different forces, spiritual forces, but the idea that there is God, creator of heaven and earth, who is master of nature, and who is able to take out one nation from another, and is able to work these miracles and bring the Jewish people out of Egypt, that's God. There's a story of a rabbi and his little grandson. Now, the rabbi is Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi, the founder of Chabad, and his grandson is the third Chabad Rebbe called the Tzemach Tzedek, Rabbi Menachem Mendel. But Rabbi Menachem Mendel was a little boy. His mother had died when he was young, very young, and he was brought up in his grandfather's home, his grandparents. So Rabbi Shneur Zalman begins playing with him. He says, who is Zayda? Who is the grandfather? Is my beard grandfather? Is my head grandfather? What's grandfather? And the little boy just looked and didn't give any answer. Then the little boy began playing a little bit more, and suddenly he got his fingers caught in the door and cried out. And his grandfather rushed over to him to see what had happened, you know, very anxious. And the little boy said, that's grandfather.
Very good.
So grandfather is that relationship when we're in pain. That's when you see the relationship. And somehow, Imoa Nochi Batzara, I'm with him together in pain, God says about us. Like that's why Moshe saw the divine revelation in the thorn bush. That even when we're in, or particularly when we are in a situation of being trapped in a thorn bush, that's when God is revealed. So it's always in the difficult, the negative situation. That's where God is revealed, but that's also where we discover the divine. Because if everything is all right, the problem with human nature is Vayishman Yeshurun Vayivat. Yeshurun, the Jewish people, got fat and comfortable and kicked. And forget about any spiritual dimension to life. So that is the paradox of human life. That really we're on the border between the physical and the spiritual. But it's very easy for us to forget that. And if everything is comfortable in our physical domain, so that's where we locate ourselves. We locate ourselves in that physical domain, and it's comfortable, we have what we need. And but in order for us to sense our connection with the divine, sometimes there needs to be a kind of the gap has to be seen. So that is the paradox of human nature and of our history. What do you say, Mark?
I was asked a question today by an 11-year-old when I was teaching. He said, the rabbi has a job, and he's paid for his job, but then should he be working on Shabbat?
And what did you say?
I said, he doesn't get paid for working on Shabbat, he's paid for it.
Well, it's an interesting question.
It is.
One way of answering the question, I mean, many kinds of, you know, people who are teachers in a boarding school. Teachers in a boarding, like Carmel College. So you have teachers there, Jewish teachers. And on Shabbat, they have certain duties. It's not a away day. They can't just leave the school. They've got to look after the children. And they have Shabbat services, but they're still teaching. So there's a concept of paying them bahavla'a. It's swallowed up with the other. It wouldn't work if you say you get £100 a day. That would be a problem, because then you come to Shabbat. So what, are you paying them for Shabbat? So you say you get £700 a week, something like that. A certain amount of money per month or annually. You don't identify the Shabbat in itself. But you have another problem. What about people like the Baal Korah? Mm-hmm. The Baal Korah who gets paid. And the only time he does anything is on Shabbat. He comes and reads the Torah. So there, the way of looking at it is, in order for him to read the Torah properly, he has to practice. So he practices in the week. That's what we're paying him for. We're not paying him for the Shabbat morning. We're paying him to practice in the week in order to get this Sedra clear. And then on Shabbat, he...
You know what I can't accept, and I find it very, very hard, especially in the posh synagogues, I don't know how it is here, but in New York, where over the Chagim, when people want to go to synagogue, Jewish tourists or whatever... You can't just walk in.
No.
You have to pay. Mm. And it's not cheap to pay. Place. And the tickets are hundreds of dollars.
You've got to have a ticket to go to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur to out.
Yeah, but you don't have to buy it. Yeah. That's different.
Of course you do.
If you're not a member of the congregation, you do.
Of course, you can't come in if you don't have a ticket. How do you get a ticket? You buy it.
No, but you're a member. That's why you get a ticket.
Yeah, but you pay your... No.
You pay your annual
fee. If you
thing,
remember...
Which includes burial and everything.
Fee,
that's different.
Yes.
But if somebody is not a member, they have to buy a ticket.
I don't think so.
Yes,
of course.
Really?
Yes.
Well, in my synagogue, everyone is welcome. In my synagogue, everyone is welcome.
I think it's appalling.
In a sense, what you buy is a seat. So it might be, you know, if someone comes in who is not a member and hasn't bought a seat, so then it's a matter of looking, you know, where is there a spare seat? Ah, so-and-so isn't here, he went to visit his sister, so here's a spare seat. You know, but the idea, look, I sympathize with you very strongly, there's a story that there was a non-Jewish guard at the entrance of the synagogue on Rosh Hashanah, and someone comes along and he hasn't got a ticket, and you know, he's not on the list, and he says, it's very important for me to go, I have to speak to someone, it's a very urgent thing, they'll be very upset if I don't go and speak to them, I'll just be there a few minutes. So the guard said, all right, you can go this time, but no praying.
I do a session at three quarters of an hour, we're just on a one-to-one with a young kid. His bar mitzvah is March 2018.
Right.
But we're working through, he already has all the brachot, his haftarah, his pasha.
Beautiful.
It's just made.
Lovely.
I don't think the father is Jewish, because the surname is Smith. But his older sister is one of the madrachim there, with the name Indigo. Mm-hmm. Very sweet.
Indigo Smith.
Well, maybe you can do more about like Jewish life in general, if he's got more than a year till it's bar mitzvah.
Yeah, well, it must be his maternal grandfather is teaching him the whole thing. But a very bright boy. Very, very bright. Mm-hmm. And the conversation.
Some children make, one child I knew made a video all about Jewish life and interviewed various people, you know, to get input on what Judaism means. Someone I know wrote a book, a 100-page book on different aspects of Judaism that they'd encountered in their studies leading to their bar or bat mitzvah. These were two siblings. One made a book, one made a film. one of them a boy and the other a girl.
So one was the script writer, the other one was the director.
The director for Tariq.
Yeah. All right, well listen, it's very powerful and and in this parsha, va'era. Va'era, the Vav and the Aleph makes, see, Va'era, so the beginning, the Vav and the Aleph is 6 and 1 is 7. So in this Sedra there are 7 plagues. And next week's Parsha is Bo, which is 2 and 1, which makes 3. There are 3 plagues. So the 10 plagues are in this week's Sedra, there are 7, and next week's Sedra, there are 3. And here we have the taste of Pesach right away with the 4 cups of wine and the 5th cup and the whole idea. But the ultimate of going out of Egypt, as I think we've often discussed, is the way that Mitzrayim is the same letters.
Is Mitzrayim.
That's right, as Mitzrayim. So Mitzrayim makes the word Egypt, and Meitzarim is the word limitations. So going out of limitations is the Yitziat Mitzrayim, the going free from Egypt every day. B'chol do vado, it says in the Haggadah, in every generation, a person should see themselves as going out of Egypt. And it basically means at the time of the Pesach Seder, you should recognize that, you know, we were also involved. But Rabbi Shneur Zalman in Tanya, he says, "B'chol do v'do, u'v'chol yom v'yom." In every generation and in every day, a person should see themselves as if they've gone out of Egypt, hayom, today. Because today we go out of Egypt. How do we go out of Egypt? The person is a divine soul which is somehow trapped by an animal soul. And the animal soul has a sort of animal perspective on life, but the in a human form, but it's basically material and so on. And inside is the divine soul. So the divine soul is trapped. But at the moment that a person studies Torah, carries out a mitzvah, prays, says the Shema, at that moment is the Yitziat Mitzrayim, it's going out of Egypt. And he writes this beautiful passage in Tanya, encouraging us to see the way that when we say, Shema Yisrael, hear O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, At that moment, God is our God, and we are bonded with God in an intense way. Like we say the God of Abraham, so we can say the God of each one of us. It's true, Abraham worked very hard to achieve that. And we just inherit it. But it's our inheritance. And we have this closeness with the divine. And just by saying the Shema with a little bit of feeling, we feel that connection to God. And there is the Yitziat Mitzrayim, going out of Egypt, going beyond all the Meitzachim. Okay.
Thank you.
Is there a gematria
for Donald Trump already?
Is there?
I'm sure there is.
Is there?